Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, June 29th. Among the things that happened over the weekend are that Mississippi decided to remove the Confederate battle emblem from the state flag. Princeton University announced it would remove Woodrow Wilson's name from its public policy school because of his racist record. And President Trump retweeted a video that included one of his supporters shouting white power twice. Did the president do that because he's evil or because he doesn't know what he's doing? Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton, said it could be the latter.
He doesn't pay attention to a lot of things. It's entirely possible that he tweeted this video because he saw the sign, I think it was in the first go-kart, that said Trump 2020 or something like that. And that's all he needed to see. Not paying attention, not considering all the implications of information he gets, is typical of Trump.
Or, having served in Trump, under Trump, and been in the room with him a lot, Bolton said it could be the former.
It may be that you can draw a conclusion that he heard it and it was racist and he tweeted it to promote the message. It's a legitimate conclusion to draw.
John Bolton on CNN State of the Union yesterday. The president did later delete the tweet, saying he hadn't noticed the white power shouts, only the other parts of the video. Here's one more clip of something that Eugene Scott is writing about in the Washington Post before we bring him on. Now, this is about a 3-minute exchange in a Senate hearing between Texas Republican John Cornyn and Vinita Gupta, president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, plus a reflection on the exchange that came later in the hearing from New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. It's about systemic and structural racism versus simple bigotry. Senator Cornyn speaks first.
I don't have very long to ask questions, so let me ask you. You changed the phrase from systemic to structural racism. What does that mean? That means everything, every institution, every person in America is a racist?
It means that there is bias built into existing institutions. And the policing, there have been any number of courageous police chiefs that have spoken to the history of systemic racism in policing as well.
Do you think systemic or structural racism can exist in a system that requires individual responsibility? Or do you think it's one or the other?
I think every American institution has been kind of shaped by these forces, and our goal is to do what we can as policymakers, as advocates, to take that out and to provide and to try to fight it in the modern day iterations that it appears.
Well, do you believe that basically all Americans are racist?
I think we all have implicit bias and racial bias. Yes, I do.
Wow.
And I think that we are an amazing country that strives to be better every single day. It's why I went to government, to make a more perfect union.
Well, you lost me when you want to take the axe of a few misguided, perhaps malicious individuals and ascribe that to all Americans, not just our 800,000 police officers, our 18,000 police departments. I think, thank you for your answer.
I just don't want to let it go past this conversation that got kind of sort of had me on the back with that somehow systemic racism means you're accusing every single person of being racist, which couldn't be farther from the truth. In fact, if you look at the businesses that have done the data analysis to find that we're paying women different than men for the same work, they were systems of systemic bias that were creating that. Was every man that worked in those businesses sexist? No, it's to me that is difficult to hear. And so what we know is that we have systems within criminal justice that produce different outcomes depending on a person's race. We have them. African-American women controlling for class to find that they die in childbirth at 3 or 4 times the rate. That means in that system, we have a racial outcome, which is systemically racist. And maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe I should turn to Jeff first. You're a political scientist. Is what I'm saying right in terms of the this idea, because it kills a conversation, and you know that, Mr. Chairman, when people think they're being accused of being racist, suddenly it stops an important academic conversation that can actually inform policy.
Senator Cory Booker, preceded by Senator John Cornyn, and Vinita Gupta, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, from a Senate hearing last week, that edit from the Washington Post. And with me now, Eugene Scott, who writes about identity politics for the Washington Post's politics site, The Fix. Thanks so much for coming on today, Eugene. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Your article about that exchange says it showcased a common and persistent misunderstanding about implicit bias and how it impacts American society. I think this is one of the most important conversations we need to be having in this country. So would you elaborate on the larger issue there?
Sure. I think what Senator Cornyn displayed is something that we hear frequently, quite frankly, from a lot of conservatives and a lot of white Americans and even a lot of men when we're talking about discrimination. Very often, individuals who find themselves on the receiving end of accusations of bias view it as an individualistic attack. They view it as something connecting directly to their character or their values or their ethics. And what Gupta was trying to explain is that bias, especially implicit bias, is very subconscious and it's developed by so many different factors that all of us suffer from it on some level. And the focus should not be on whether or not we suffer from it. The data supports that that's the case. Her work and the work of many other lawmakers on that panel is trying to get around it and trying to not allow it to shape the policy and the politics that affect so many Americans, because that's what the real focus should be, not on whether or not an individual is racist. The attention needs to be on whether policy has different implications on people of color versus white people. And that is what she was trying to explain. But I think what Senator Cornyn was getting to is that for many Americans, the idea that they could be motivated by racial preferences is just so concerning or even offensive to them that they tend not to be able to get past that. And one of the reasons that is so troubling is because, quite frankly, it centers people like Cornyn, opposed to the low-income black people that his policies actually have real implications for.
As Senator Booker noted at the very end of that clip, and you also quote Philip Atiba Goff, CEO of the research organization Center for Policing Equity, when people talk about racism in public, they often mean bigotry. But systemic racism, as you were also just describing, is about something else. Can you describe what they're talking about, sort of in light of what Booker said there at the very end, that the word racism becomes a conversation stopper when it shouldn't be?
Right. Yeah, I think what the Senator Booker here was getting to is that what Cornyn heard was Gupta suggest that people are hateful and mean directly and consciously motivated by their disgust for people of color when making decisions and saying things. And that's not what she was saying at all. That's not what systemic racism is at all, nor is that what implicit bias is at all. Her point was that there are laws and rules and systems put in place, regardless of the motivation, that negatively affect people of color in ways that it does not negatively affect white people. And so the motivations behind the policies are largely irrelevant when we're talking about outcomes. And that is why when looking at something like policing, you have to realize that whether or not an individual meant any harm, harm is being done, and that lawmakers can make decisions to prevent those harms from happening or perhaps decrease the gap between how black and white people experience policing in this country.
and beyond policing, if, for example, as is true, black women giving birth die in childbirth at a much higher rate than white women, it's not because the OBGYNs, even if they're largely white, hate black pregnant women. It's something much more systemic than that, that doesn't have to do with that. And so
absolutely.
Is that a good example? Go ahead.
It is. It very much is. I was in a conversation yesterday about a doctor. She's a white woman, and she tweeted a TikTok that went viral where she's explaining how implicit bias has surfaced in the medical community. And one of the ways is that there's been this long-held belief that black people do not have, or should I say, have a higher pain tolerance than white people. And this mindset was used to justify slavery and other forms of systemic discrimination. But the way that manifests now is that there are times when black patients, black women perhaps, to stick with the example you were going with earlier, maybe aren't given as much anesthesia or as much care as white women when going through childbirth because of the racial bias that's based on faulty science that says that black women don't hurt as much as white women. Now, when a white doctor is leaning into that, it's not always because they're hateful or bigot or mean. It's because the system in which they have operated in has a bias against black women, and there are real ramifications for that, as Booker was noting when we start talking about things like mortality rates of black women after giving birth.
And one interesting thing that your source Goff told you is that from a scientific perspective, attitudes like prejudice and bigotry are weak predictors of behavior. What did he have in mind with that? Or is the example you just gave maybe the best example?
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to follow up with him on that to understand more of the point that he was making. Perhaps his he was trying to reference that just because someone has a prejudice or a bias does not always mean that that will surface in some of the decisions they make and some of their actions. But I wasn't completely clear, but certainly wanted to study more about what he has written on the topic.
One other thing about the exchange between Cornyn and Vinita Gupta, the clip started with Cornyn observing that Gupta took a reference to systemic racism and changed it to structural racism. Do you, or does she, as you understand it, see a difference between those two terms?
From my understanding, they're largely interchangeable. And what she was trying to get to was that in the systems, in the structures that we look to run our society, racism is present at the core or at multiple levels and has effects in ways that are difficult to number because they're so intrinsic. And so I think her choice of words, I think, was with the intent to maybe better, explain or help those struggling with the idea to latch on to a familiar word that could be easier to comprehend on their part, but ultimately means the same thing.
Nina in Cortona, you're on WNYC. Nina, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm kind of nervous, but I think I can get through this with some help.
Okay, we'll give you support.
Thank you so much. I want to talk about language and systemically, linguistically racist language, because it feels very clear to me that right now people are looking at racism in a new light and understanding fundamentally what it means for something to be a construct, for something to be invented, for race to be invented, right? We all agree it's not real. It's a word we came up with, and then look what we did with that word. Mm-hmm. Now we're trying to undo it, and we're taking huge leaps forward in renaming things, even just re-examining things. But while we're doing that, the word race, racism, racist, anti-racist, we're saying the word over and over so loudly. We have to. We're trying to undo it. It's a big task. But in saying the word over and over, this thing that we've agreed upon is not real. We're reinforcing its existence.
What's the alternative?
And what we need.
What's the alternative since racism is real?
We need new words. We need new language. We need to look to the kids and say, hey, guess what? We have ideas now that our limited language doesn't support anymore. Or we have new ideas, but we need new words. We need to do what does Germany do? They mush words together to get like a bigger concept. Hmm. Don't they do that in Japan? There are words that refer to entire concepts. We have to do it, and it can be interesting and fun. The first word that we need is we are a blank of humans. We're not a race of humans. We're not a country of humans. We are a blank of humans. Are we a tribe? Mm-hmm. Are we a community? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are we a gaggle? Are we a pack? Are we a school? What are we? Let's move towards that. We have to have the language. We have to have the possibility of hope in addition to examining exactly where we are and where we came from.
I'm going to have to go for time, but thank you for laying that out. And you did great. See, no reason to be nervous. You were eloquent, and you made your points.
Thank you. My heart is like a pitter-patter.
thank you very much, Nina. But Eugene, do you want to react to that? I mean, certainly, you know, adjunct to that, I've heard some mostly white people say, if we could stop using the word racism with systemic racism, because it does generally conjure up the idea of hate and bigotry and, you know, malicious hate and bigotry, that maybe more people from Senator Cornyn on down would understand.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that argument as well, and I do understand the concern to some degree. And I don't think this is what the caller was getting to, but the word racism does have to continue being used because it still exists. I mean, we have seen over the past few months a spike in the number of crimes against Asians in America connected in part to racist language tied to the coronavirus pandemic. And
right.
So,
but that's the malicious kind, right?
To
draw the distinction that Cornyn was making.
Absolutely. But the context of racism that perhaps may not be motivated by malice, language matters. I obviously deal with words. You and I deal with communication all the time. But I don't think the majority of the attention should be on getting rid of language or even changing language as much as dealing with the impact of racist policies and ideas, because that is real and unchanging and something that we have way more control over right now than I think we did in the past, because people are more attuned now to this conversation, whether they like it or are uncomfortable with it or not. But as we, you know, move forward and discover better words to better describe where we are and what we're experiencing, I can imagine that there will be some words that we let go of. I do not know if racism is one of them.
I want to get to the related story, the kind of systemic racism that we've been describing. Maybe we could say, unlike someone shouting white power in a pro-Trump group, you heard John Bolton's response to the president retweeting the video that included that. That Trump might just not have listened closely enough, which would be typical in Bolton's experience of him, but also he could have been just promoting the message. How big is that group getting now for you as a Washington correspondent, who even grew up in Washington, I happen to know, how big is that group getting of former Trump appointees who are willing to suggest openly that they believe, the president believes, racist things or uses anti-black racism consciously in his politics?
Well, it's certainly larger than anything we've ever heard in the past regarding alums of lawmakers still in office. And it should be concerning to those still siding with the president, because people who have worked closely with him and are more attuned to his heart and perhaps mind and motivations seem to question whether or not his motives are as pure as he suggests they are when he, you know, rarely apologizes or tries to move in another direction. But I think the most important point about all of this, and this is a theme I think I've, you know, hit a few times in this conversation, is whether or not the president is aware that he is putting forward racist ideas is almost irrelevant and maybe even more concerning. I mean, the fact that he puts them forward and they have a real impact, the fact that people who are not black, people who are not white can go on the Twitter feed of their president and see something like white power declared, it's very concerning. And something like a reply like "my bad" or "I didn't know," it's really insufficient to people who surveys show largely believe that racism is one of the biggest problems in this country today.
Yeah, and that "my bad, I didn't know" response from him reminds me of his 2016 campaign, when David Duke, prominent Klan person, endorsed him, and he tried to wriggle out of denouncing Duke and that endorsement by saying he doesn't know anything about David Duke. But then it came to light through old video that he had squarely denounced Duke years earlier when he wasn't running for president and clearly knew who he was. So he was trying to play both sides then and maybe now.
Absolutely. And I think that is why those who are convinced that the president is racist, which recent polling shows is most Americans, aren't convinced that Trump is as unaware as some of those who are trying to be as gracious towards him may suggest.
Last thing then, with your political analyst hat on, there have been polls lately showing that Black Lives Matter as a phrase and as a group is becoming more popular in America, in fact is approved of by a majority in the polls that I've seen, while at the same time Trump is going downhill with, importantly, sectors that supported him in swing states, including older white Americans, which Republican presidential candidates usually win. So I'm just curious how you see the political impact so far, and I realize we have a long way to go before Election Day, but so far, of Trump's behavior, both toward anti-racism protests and the coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, there has been nothing coming from the White House suggesting that the president is going to pivot when it comes to his response to anti-racism protests or the coronavirus pandemic. And as we see groups of Americans directly affected by these issues, beyond those that historically have been affected, we can see and expect frustrations with how the president has responded to them to grow. What I mean by that is, if you think about 5 years ago in the Mike Brown killing in Ferguson, Missouri, the protesters were largely young Black people in inner cities. But right now, we are seeing protests in Idaho and Wyoming and Arizona and crowds that are largely white and connected to voting blocs that have backed the president. And so it's hitting closer to home. There are evangelicals out there voting. There are suburban moms out there voting. They're independent. Protesting. And therefore, they are directly affected in ways that they haven't been before. And that will determine perhaps how they vote in November.
Eugene Scott writes about identity politics for the Washington Post's website, The Fix. Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.